Tony TV. Inspiring people across the planet to be a little kinder and a little more gentle with each other. Delivering inspirational TV, one story at a time, from my lounge to yours. I'm your host, Tony Lontis.
Resilience, memoir of a broken little girl, discovering a woman of strength and beauty is the new book from Australian author Tony Lontis. Available in paper, ebook and audio formats, Resilience is the true life story of Tony experiencing and surviving trauma, abuse, mental health issues and the ultimate betrayal of someone she fell in love with. Available for download now through all good online retailers and in all good bookstores.
But my hearing just got worse and worse to where finally I had to retire. Then I got this cochlear implant where I have this little microprocessor embedded in my skull with wires going into my cochlea to where all of a sudden I can hear again, but it's not perfect. So that's why I wanted to see your face so I could sort of half read your lips. But so.
Okay.
I still probably will have to ask you at times to repeat yourself because I'll miss certain words, like the words you just used. I wasn't sure what that was.
That's fine.
Okay. That's fine. Okay.
Welcome to Radio Tony.
Thank you.
I'm so delighted to speak to you live on air today. What an amazing opportunity to have a guest of your caliber on Radio Tony. It's fabulous that you could join me this afternoon. So just for our listeners, your psychology background goes way back. So you have been
way back. I'm 80 years old now. So yes, it does go way back. So,
I'm just going to interject
years
here.
Young. I'm thinking, I can't believe it.
We didn't really
That's
start
That's even
yet.
More special for you to be on Radio Tony today.
Thank you.
So, Nicholas, you have written 7 books, haven't you?
Yes. The first was back in 2002. Gwendolyn is Mother, which really got into how to deal with traumas in a person's childhood.
Yes.
And, I really felt that the whole story of Beowulf really followed the steps of psychotherapy in helping an adult recover from those early childhood trauma.
Because they certainly present a lot of problems for adults when they haven't dealt with childhood traumas, don't they?
Oh, definitely, yes. And that was a big part of my practice. I guess most everybody, I mean, the word trauma is sort of narrow. I used to think of it in a very broad sense where it just something simple like one of the case studies I often refer to is the father would walk through the kitchen and see his son playing on the floor with pots and pans and sigh in disgust because he wanted his son to become a doctor like the father was.
Yes.
And so, I mean, that really was abusive in one way, but it really, it's hard to call that trauma. So I think there's a wide, I think of a very wide range of things that have happened in childhood that could be interpreted as trauma.
Yeah, there's a lot. Trauma is different to the individual, isn't it?
Exactly. This young boy, he felt like he could never please his father. And when he got to college, he was very smart, but he kept sabotaging himself and not studying and dropping out of classes because he just didn't feel like he could live up to what his father expected.
Yeah. And that's something as simple as the words and treatment of a parent. And then you've got the other end of the scale where there's sexual or physical abuse as well.
Abuse.
And all of that is
trauma. Exactly. There's a wide range of different kinds of trauma.
Do you think,
go ahead.
Do you think that it depends on the individual's personality in terms of how resilient they are as to how that trauma impacts on their lives?
Yes. I mean, it depends on so many factors. Where do they learn that resilience? I mean, that resilience isn't necessarily inborn. It's also learned from the family constellation in some ways.
Yes.
There's a whole other area of, it's hard to call it trauma or abuse, but as a child, we're taught so many things that really have never been validated in reality. I think of myself, I was left-handed and dyslexic, and I thought I was very inadequate, but which was sort of an unfair way of looking at myself. And just a few years back, I all of a sudden realized that the dyslexic person is often very creative. And all of a sudden, I felt free of the burden I had carried for so many years of this false belief.
Yes.
I mean, whether it's religious or educational, I mean, so many of our religious beliefs have never really been validated either. I mean, if something goes wrong, if I get sick, is that a sin? You know, it's not necessarily. I think those little things like that, that some people are brought up believing, is really a handicap too.
Yeah. I absolutely agree with you, particularly around some of those religious beliefs as to what is good and what is bad, what is sin, what is not. They can strain an individual from exploring what might be their full potential.
Right.
Yeah.
Very true.
Yeah. So the first book was in 2002, and that was Grendel and his mum, his mother, pardon me. And then in 2013, The Power of Ecstatic Trance, Practices for Healing Spiritual Growth and Accessing the Universal Mind. This I found fascinating. So can you tell me about its inception and what you wanted to achieve with that book?
Okay, sure. That's great. As a psychologist over the years, over the 35, 40 years I practiced psychology, I used a lot of hypnosis. And I found it a very effective tool in therapy. So often the trauma in our childhood is often repressed or forgotten or learned pre-verbally. It's just we don't know it. Yeah. And by having you go back in time to your childhood and re-experience those trauma, really bring them alive. So I really used hypnosis in that sense of uncovering the source of the trauma or the problems that we have. Then in about 2007, I think it was, I was president of the American Association for the Study of Mental Imagery, and I was organizing for the annual conference, and someone said, oh, you need to get as a keynote speaker Felicitas Goodman. And I didn't know anything about her at the time, but as a result of that suggestion, I quickly got her book and read her book, Where the Spirits Ride the Wind.
Yes.
And so that really changed my life. It really, who she was, is she was born in Hungary and raised in Germany, and educated in Germany.
Yes.
And she learned many different languages. She really was a linguist. When she came to this country, she knew probably 20 or more languages. And she ended up at the Ohio State University campus, where she was very popular in terms of translating literature for the faculty. Yeah. And while there, she decided to, she met an anthropologist who was studying ecstatic trance in like 180 different indigenous cultures around the world.
Yes.
And ecstatic trance is a shamanic form of trance that really is induced by rapid stimulation to the nervous system, whether it was through drumming or rattling but anyway, she decided when she met this professor that she was going to get her PhD in anthropology. And she decided, she realized that speaking in tongues in the apostolic churches was a form of ecstatic trance.
Yeah.
And so she went to Mexico and studied the Mayan speaking and the Spanish speaking apostolic churches about what brought about ecstatic trance, what brought them to speak in tongues. And she realized that there was four different elements that were important. First, the belief that speaking in tongues was healthy and not crazy. It was acceptable. Two, it was done in a sacred or special place. Three, there was something that quieted the person's mind in the church. It was through prayer.
Yeah.
And then four, what brought about the trance was the rapid hand clapping in the church. So she came back to her students. By then she was teaching at Denison University in Ohio. She came back to her students and created a more of an indigenous ritual that included those four elements.
Yeah.
She would talk to the students about what it meant to go into a trance, that it wasn't crazy, it was okay, it was acceptable. It was she would create the sacred space by smudging with smoke of some sort, of some herbal smoke, and then calling the spirits of each of the directions. She then would have a person follow their breathing for 5 minutes to quiet their mind.
Yes.
And then four, she used a rattle or a drum to stimulate the nervous system to bring about trance. And she discovered that the trance was, the students did go into a trance, but it was very unorganized. It was very undirected.
Okay.
And she realized that in the church, as well as in these indigenous communities, there was always another purpose. In the church, it was waiting to be moved by the Holy Spirit. And in the indigenous communities, it was the shaman was seeking ways to heal a person or the community or the family or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
But that was missing in her four steps. Then she read an article by a Canadian psychologist, V.F. Emerson, who was looking at the postures used by in various meditations, lotus posture, the different yoga postures, and in different forms of meditation. And he was measuring a person's breathing rate, skin moisture, temperature, bowel motility. He was measuring a bunch of different physiological features and discovered that the posture had a direct effect on what happened in the meditation experience.
Yeah.
So a light went on for Felicitas, and she started searching through museums and primitive art books to find postures that she believed were used by the shaman of these communities. And she found like about 50 different postures that she believed were shamanic. And she had the students sit, stand, or lay in these postures. And sure enough, their experiences became very directed. You going to say something?
So those experiences of hers with ecstatic trance actually predate Christianity. Is that my understanding?
Oh, very. Yeah, it's really.
She
looked at the hunter and gatherers. She was looking at the shaman from the hunter and gatherers communities, whether they were ancient back 20,000 years ago.
So 10, well before ago, Christianity.
Or more recent, in the recent indigenous or hunter and gatherer cultures too. But yes, these were very ancient cultures. Our ancestors are, but our hunting, I think of them as our hunter and gathering ancestors.
Yeah.
What happened then is what was so powerful about this research, this is the turning point, she found that these postures produced seven or eight different experiences. Some postures brought about a sense of healing energy, a strengthening healing energy coming into the body. Most common posture for that we call the bear spirit posture, where you're standing with your hands on your lower abdomen, where you could feel yourself breathing from your diaphragm, the healthy way of breathing.
Yes.
That was one of the first postures that we used that was quite powerful. Then there were the postures for shape-shifting, or what she calls metamorphosis, where I would become an animal. The clearest posture there was the Olmec Prince posture, where from Mexico, where he's sitting on the floor cross-legged with the knuckles of his hands on the ground in front of him. And sort of like four legs.
Yes.
And that was one of the first postures I ever used, and I very quickly felt myself becoming a bear, where I was just sort of lumbering along the road, around a pathway through the woods. And it's one of my favorite postures. Then there were the postures for divination, finding answers to questions.
Yes.
And the typical one is the one I like is the Lady of Cholula, where you're sitting erect with your hands on your knees. But even more clear is the Olmec Diviner, where she has her hand up in front of her face, sort of.
Yes.
When I've asked the people in my groups, what does it remind you of? Right away, they think of the thinker. There's an opening. There's a space there for the message to come in, rather than sort of brewing inside of yourself. So the divination postures are very much where you're really attending, where you're really waiting intently for an answer to a question. Then there are the three journeying postures, some for going into the underworld, which is generally a laying down posture. Then there is the middle world postures, or journeying in our world. And the typical one there is the from the Mediterranean island. She's a very heavy set woman. Her head's missing on the statue, but she's pointing to the ground with one hand and the other hand's across her chest. She's basically saying, "Here I am. This is where I belong on this earth." Then there are the upper world postures, where often you're pointing to the upper world, looking at the sky, or lying on a 37 degree ramp. 37 degrees has become pretty significant there, so that she's measured, where you're not stably connected to the earth, but ready to rise up to the upper world. That's three, four, five, six of the postures. The seventh one is the death rebirth, or initiation posture.
Yes.
And typically, my favorite there is the feathered serpent, where you're standing with your hands on your hips.
Yes.
And when I ask the students in the groups, what does that remind you of? They think right away, well, my mother's angry at me for something I didn't do, or something I did do that I shouldn't have.
Yeah.
But when you look at from what it means to the mother, it's a posture of determination. I'm determined to let a part of me that's unhealthy die, and a healthy part be reborn. That's a sense of determination.
Yeah.
That's seven. The eighth one, there's just two or three postures for celebration or calling the spirits, where one is where you have your hands on your chest, your mouth open. But we now have a collection of like 190, almost 200 postures, and they invariably fit in one of these eight categories. And so the postures have become very, very powerful, and I really value them in that sense. Go ahead.
The postures in combination with entering that trance or meditative space. So it is like a meditative space, isn't it?
Yes.
And it's the combination of the... It's the combination
The drumming and the posture, they really do lead you into an altered state of consciousness. I think of another way I look at it is that over the Gene Gibser in his book The Ever-Present Origin, he looks at the evolution of consciousness. Our very early ancestral consciousness was a dreamlike consciousness. Then there was the shaman, and it was more magical. Then they moved into the mythical consciousness, where things were explained by myth. Yeah. And then we moved into, about 2,500 years ago, moved into the what we call the rational. And the rational was where everything that's real is, it comes through our five senses: sight, sound, taste, touch, and smell. And that's reality. And we lost so much of going beyond seeing what we could do. And even
that's
our dreams,
spiritual.
Even though the spirit, our dreams are so important, but through much of that 2,500 years, dreams are considered untrue and meaningless and just random thoughts, when in fact they have much meaning to it. So that's a bridge to the earlier time. But then there's the different trance states, whether it's hypnosis or, in this case, a static trance. And
so, Dr. Brink, the difference between ecstatic trance and hypnosis, there's a clear difference between those two. So hypnosis is you connecting with someone's subconscious, whereas ecstatic trance and the postures that you use for healing are something that the patient can consciously do.
It's both. I mean, ecstatic trance is for connecting with the unconscious too, but there's a different energy.
Yes.
In hypnosis, it's a quieting. I talk slowly and following your breathing. And it's sort of if you've read Carlos Castaneda, he talks about dreaming and stalking. Hypnosis is more of the dreaming, while ecstatic trance has more of a direct direction, a stalking direction of going to the very, very same thing. Some people are much more available to, much more effective in doing it through stalking or through ecstatic trance. Those are the ones that are think too much and try too hard, and they can't let go to really get into a hypnotic state. And so I find ecstatic trance has been very effective in therapy because of that. This brings out a whole other side of the person.
So you use ecstatic trance in your practice for healing and emotional and spiritual growth?
Like I said, I'm retired from that practice, but I still do it. Well, I have. What happened is, when I was president of the American Association for the Study of Mental Imagery, I was planning this conference, and they were going to have Felicitas Goodman be the keynote speaker, but then everything went wrong. This was we were doing this at Penn State University, and the printer did not come out with the brochure until about 2 weeks before the conference. There was hardly anybody registered for it, and so the university decided to cancel the conference. But as a result, having read her book, and I was part of the International Association for the Study of Dreams, at the Dream Conference, I did a 4-morning workshop using ecstatic trance. And that was the first time I had ever used it. And it blew me away how those seven categories were so accurate. I mean, that was so obvious. Yes, I had a captive audience of people who were interested in their dreams.
Yes.
But they really validated. So I came home and I started a group. And that was back in 2007. And since then, I've had groups all around the country. In Europe, too. I've had a couple, two or three of them in Europe. And up here in the Hudson Valley, I have two groups going now. I've only been here for just a year, but I had a very quick response, and I have like 20 people involved in these two groups, one on Friday mornings and one on Tuesday evenings. And if any listeners want to, now I'm doing these groups over Zoom. We're not going into the homes. And I'd be very happy to have the listeners come connect with me and join our two Zoom groups that we have.
What's the best way to connect with you, Dr. Brink?
My email, I think, brinknick9, just brinknick9@gmail.com.
That's pretty
the most
simple.
Effective way.
Nick9@gmail.com.
Right. Brinknick9, I mean, I think that's, I'd be happy to, I have quite a few new people coming to these Zoom groups from as far away as Germany and in the West Coast of Seattle and British Columbia and Canada. Mm-hmm. And so, it's been exciting doing it over Zoom because I'm just not stuck here in the Hudson Valley. I'm getting people from all across the planet.
And they work just as well over Zoom.
Hmm?
They work just as well over Zoom versus face to face.
What's been extra nice about Zoom is there's probably 40, 50 different that's what I was going to say a few minutes ago. As a result of starting the groups in Pennsylvania when I was living there, when I had questions, I quickly found Belinda Gore's email address, and she's written two books on ostatic trance. She was a student of Felicitas Goodman. Felicitas died before I really had a chance to meet her face to face. I did talk to her on the telephone a couple times, but Belinda became a great resource and convinced me to go to the Cuamungi Institute, which is above Santa Fe in New Mexico, where I was trained to become a certified instructor. And there's probably 40 or 50 certified instructors around the world now teaching ostatic trance. And in these Zoom groups that I have like five or six of the other instructors that have been joining us. And it's great to have in the group, to have the people in the group experience how other instructors are doing it, are calling the spirits of each direction. Each of us have sort of a different litany of calling the spirits. And so it's fun to just really to see how the other instructors are doing it too. So that's something special that I think we have going right now.
So, Dr. Nick, you have obviously been, I'm not sure what the American word is. In Australia, it's a lockdown or stay at home. In America, there's another word that you guys use about around the coronavirus and having to stay home. So have you been in lockdown?
Yeah, sort of lockdown or social distancing. I had a full beard up until about 3 or 4 weeks ago because I discovered wearing the mask, somehow the beard interfered with the mask. So I shaved my chin so that I could wear the mask more comfortably. So we've been having a...
Your next book after The Power of Ecstatic Trance was Boulder's Magic, and talking about the power of Norse shamanship and ecstatic trance. So tapping into a particular period of human history, and in particular the Norse?
Yes. I don't have any real... Oh, yes, I do, but not with the Norse. I discovered I have a gene that over 50% of the Sami reindeer herders have. So I think I'm part Sami in that sense from Lapland. But somehow after reading Beowulf and writing Grendel and his mother, I really realized how I resonated with the Nordic mythology. And then I read the prose Edda and the poetic Edda of Loki and Thor and Odin. And again, that's I have another book I have not found a publisher for yet. But Loki's Children, again, I find that really does also follow the outline of psychotherapy. But as a result of that, I just really started going back to the prose Edda and poetic Edda stories and sitting with them while in a static trance. And a whole new world of those stories came up. I mean, I really felt like, well, where it began is the Halsted warrior posture, where you're standing with your hand on your chest and your shoulders are up like you're, what he calls a realm of the dead posture. I did that one, and I found myself in Halstead, Germany, where again the known ancestors are from. Yeah. And I really felt this was 6,000 years ago. I really felt that the person that I met on this experience was an ancestor. I really felt like I was connecting with my direct ancestors, and that was the beginning of a whole series of experiences of going throughout Scandinavia, where I really felt like I was connecting with my ancestors. So it's really, Baldur's Magic is really an ancestral book.
Yes.
The next one, though, was Baldur's Magic. Beowulf's Ecstatic Trance Magic.
Yes.
And there I didn't feel like I was connecting with my direct ancestors, but I had spent quite a bit of time in Denmark and Sweden at the sites of Beowulf's Great Hall and Queen Welthero's family that was in Sweden, and that was Beowulf's queen. And I had a big question. How does a woman put up with the aggressiveness of someone like Beowulf? I mean, someone like King Hrothgar of the story of Beowulf. I mean, I think that women just somehow put up with this aggressiveness of men that, to me, how do they do it? And so that book of Beowulf's Ecstatic Trance Magic really was looking at how did Queen Welthero cope with the violence and energy of her powerful Viking warrior husband.
Yes.
And so it was a sort of I really enjoyed writing that book too. So those are the two that are the ones that are basically Scandinavian, just because I somehow really resonated with that culture. I really felt like it was part of who I was.
So,
But you're going through the books that I've written.
I know.
The next one.
Yeah.
Okay. The next one was
Transient Journeys of the Hunter-Gatherers, Ecstatic Practices to Reconnect with the Great Mother and Heal the Earth.
Yes, exactly. And what I realized in that is so many of the experiences I had were really connected to the earth and healing the earth. Some of the funnest ones is I've done a couple workshops at conferences where I had the person go into a particular posture. I'm not too sure which ones I use right now, but with the thought in mind of, going back to their childhood. I think our children are much more connected with nature. I mean, climbing trees, and one of my favorites is just, I lived in Los Angeles, and I put a leaf in the water running along the gutter along the street and follow it as it floated down to the drain. I mean, that was so, there was so many things that children do that connect with nature that somehow as adults, they get pushed out of us. We forget about it. We think that it was childish. We think it's meaningless. But going back and reliving those, I had you're from being from Australia. One of the people in my group was from southwest Australia. He lived right there on the beach on the water edge there, and he recalls so many stories of just his time in his experiences in Australia that really was a lie to him. But I think there's so many different postures, so many different experiences that bring the earth again alive to us, something that we, and I think for global warming, for saving the earth, we really need to reconnect with the spirits of the earth and our spirit guides. I mean, I have about 20 or 30 spirit guides. The first was a bear.
Oh, fascinating.
The first spirit guide was the bear. It was back when I was diagnosed with prostate cancer, and it was a healing posture. But then I've gone through so many other. I have here's one of my bears. I have a bunch of bears around here, but I have a squirrel, an eagle. The coyote is one of the more recent ones. The coyote was always challenging me to look at something differently. So that's been over the last several years, that's been the more powerful spirit guide. But and I have all kinds of fetishes and all around the desk here of the different spirit guides. But I think that this really connecting with our spirit guides really brings the earth alive to us too.
Yes. Because the spirits are connected to the earth themselves, aren't they?
Yes. What is the spirit? Okay, that's something that on this outline I sent you, I said it was optional.
Yes.
But I think there's a whole universal mind. I'll get into it briefly here. There's a whole...
Yeah, no, that's wonderful.
I think that we think when if I ask you, where within you are you? Where within you do you exist? Most of us Westerners point to our head. It's our brain.
My heart.
The indigenous people point to their heart.
Yeah.
There's a direct connection between the heart and the brain. The heart is not just a pump. It's a brain. It's an endocrine gland. Listening from the heart is so important. And that listening from the heart is where you're connecting with emotions.
Yeah.
Also, there's the brain of the gut. This is your intestines, your gut, your solar plexus. To me, that's more of the intuitive insight. You get your insights from that brain within you.
Yes.
But it's, and I think doing the ecstatic trance induction, when you're following your breathing, you're bringing it down to your diaphragm. That really does bring your attention down to closer to your heart and into your stomach. So I think that's an important, really important part of listening to the world beyond you. But there's so much research in quantum physics, in I guess the first when I first went to the Institute, Belinda Gore told me that one of Felicitas Goodman's interests was Rupert Sheldrake. And so because of that, I read his books. And he points out how we think of the atoms as being composed of an electromagnetic field that holds the electrons and neutrons together in the atom. We think of the universe as being held together by a gravitational field. These fields are important.
They are.
When you look at the body, you don't think of those fields.
No, but they're there.
When you think of the cell within your body is composed of all these molecules that are held together by the electromagnetic field, that these fields are very much alive within us. And he calls them morphic fields in the body. But we have each cell of our body has a field that's holding it together. And then they come together, and each organ of our body, our liver, we have a morphic field that creates our liver that holds it together. We have a morphic field that holds our whole body together. And that morphic field connects us with other human beings. And each animal has their own morphic fields. Mm. And so we connect with all life through these morphic fields. And he gives so many stories of one of my favorites is the blue tit is a bird in England. It learned how to somehow peck at the cap of a milk bottle sitting on someone's stoop, delivered on their step. And how quick the tit learned how to peck off the cap and get and drink the milk.
Yeah.
And that little behavior spread so rapidly across the English Channel to France and throughout Europe, where they these birds were learning much more rapidly than just having a direct connection with each other. And it was through their morphic field that this, and he really believed it was through the morphic field that this information was being passed on. And he gives so many examples of that. And when you look at quantum physics, I don't want to necessarily get into that. That gets pretty deep. But there's
I was going to ask you about the connection with epigenetics. I know that's not in our topics, but I just wondered how you felt about the connection with what we're talking about and epigenetics. I know, we're going to run out of time, aren't we?
that's a long story. No, the idea of non-local coherence, when an atom is split, divided, it may go in opposite directions at a great distance, but what happens to one automatically happens to the other part. There's so many different aspects of quantum physics. There's the observer thing that they now realize that if you observe what we observe, it becomes what we observe. That's a whole very complicated process, but it's sort of interesting. But all these things connect. And so even though as a psychologist using hypnosis, I sometimes had people connect with a past life. And back then, I thought that was just a metaphor for something that's happening in their life now, and I didn't necessarily believe it.
Okay.
But now I really do believe it. I believe that we have the ability to connect with everything that's ever happened on this planet.
Yeah.
And there is a universal mind. There's a mind that's beyond us. And Irving Laszlo goes into it in great detail. I have so many studies that demonstrate that this the existence of this universal mind beyond us. And so I find that so often, I think just in these groups of ecstatic trance that I have, how often our experiences are very much alike. I remember one simple one, I saw this big orange moon while another woman in the group saw a big orange ring of cheese. We so often have, it's expected. It's expected that there's a real commonality between our experiences within the group. And it's part of that idea of the universal mind that we are able to connect that way. I didn't want to spend too much time on that because I wanted to get into the last book of Aesthetic Soul Retrieval.
Yes.
Let's see. I'm looking at the outline that I sent you here.
Yes.
Sheldrake Carr. Okay. Let's get down. How much time are we to the
You're
breaking
right.
Point
we've still got time. I'll give you a little cue when we're out of time. So we've still got time. This is a fascinating discussion. So yes, I want to get onto that last book of yours.
Okay. Let's start with talking about analytic hypnotherapy. I think that's
yes.
sort of, or I'll bring the two together. Keith Solomon from Germany taught a workshop at the Institute on soul retrieval. And
yes.
We're good friends now, and we communicate back and forth. And she said it was just, the idea just came to her when her friend came over and they were talking about it. But I've sort of ran with it and wrote a book about it, and she's excited about that.
Yeah.
But what we did is, I did the soul retrieval workshop with Key,
yes.
and really recognized how parallel it was with analytic hypnotherapy. So in analytic hypnotherapy, we begin with usually a ego strengthening exercise, because we know we're going to be facing something painful, some trauma in the person's life. So we need to have some exercise to feel strong enough to really face this trauma. When the person comes to therapy, they are on the edge. They have the strength to face it. That's the reason why they've come. But just an initial, with each breath, feel the sense of strength flowing into you hypnotically, and feel yourself stronger and stronger. Then we use what we call the affect bridge. You come to me with some sort of problem. It could be a behavioral problem, but it has an emotional content to it. You may feel very anxious. You may be depressed. You may be obsessing about something. We take the affect, the emotion, and hypnotically take it back through time, carry the feeling back with you as you go back through time, using time regression. And you come to the source of the beginning of that feeling of anxiety or depression or whatever it is.
Uh-huh.
And you look at where it began. Using a very common one, let's say your father was fighting with your mother, and you would go hide in the bedroom with the pillow over your head trying to not hear the fight.
Yeah.
Okay. But the anxiety, the fear may take you back to a story like that or some other story. In analytic hypnotherapy, then Edgar Barnett in Canada, what he added to it is he would suggest have your adult self, with the strength and understanding of your adult self, go back with your younger self and help your younger self find the strength to understand. That was very cathartic. It just sort of it didn't really provide a very direct solution to the problem. But it was sort of more like psychoanalysis, where you'd rely on catharsis. What I've added to that is I have the person identify what they needed to hear. If I say, I don't want Dad to be abusive, that doesn't tell you what you do need.
Yeah.
I mean, I have you come up with as many different ways to say what you do need. Dad, I need to have you be gentle. Dad, I need to have you be able to listen and understand how I feel.
Yeah.
Dad, I need to have you protect me. Mom, I need to have you protect me.
Yeah.
I have them come up with as many different positive ways of saying it.
Yes.
And then hypnotically, I have them rehearse hypnotic rehearsal of being that better parent, being the gentle, being the good listener, being the understanding parent figure, so where you become what you didn't receive in your childhood. And then they go out and with the people they work with their children, with their friends, as they become this new person that is able to listen, who's able to be gentle, who's they discover that how positive the experience is.
Yes.
So it's a very, in my mind, it's a much more direct way of healing, of taking the painful experience and
making it positive.
And hypnotically giving him the strength, a healing strength. When it comes to, that's sort of a basic outline of analytic hypnotherapy.
Yes.
Yeah. When it comes to the ecstatic soul retrieval, the bear spirit posture, the healing, the strengthening healing posture where you're bringing in the healing, strengthening energy from the bear, that's the same thing as the beginning of the analytic hypnotherapy of finding that strength.
Yeah.
Then I use a divination posture to define what the emotion is, what the connection is. And then using an underworld posture, we go into the unconscious mind and carry you through those experiences of when it comes to ecstatic trance, there's much less talking than with hypnosis. With with ecstatic trance, it's the posture that gives the direction. So I really don't have to say much. And the experience that the person has is often very metaphoric. It may not be real. It's like a nighttime dream, but it's much more metaphoric. But the answers are there. As you go into the underworld, the experiences you see would be a metaphoric description of the abuse. And again, using the underworld posture of finding what you need, finding the answer, the solution to the problems, is also the same way. It's often metaphoric, but the answer is embedded in it. And you may not understand what the answer is right away, but if you hang on to it, if you stay with it, eventually it makes sense. But I don't think it has to make sense right away. It could be metaphoric and you still find the healing.
Do you, Dr. Nick, do you get your clients to write down about their experiences? And their messages?
With hypnosis, I didn't. I had my notes. I would have them, I would say, yes, okay, go back into the trance experience you had the last session and see where it takes you. I think with hypnosis, once you learn how to go into a trance, it becomes very automatic. And if I say, go back to your dream, they go back into a dream state very quickly, or go back to this trance experience, they go into a trance.
Okay.
Initially, I may, in as a psychologist, I hardly ever use the word hypnosis.
Okay.
That's a whole other line of thinking here. To me, what hypnosis is using the yes set.
Yes.
In other words, I reflect back to you with an understanding that you're answering yes. I'm very careful about wording things the way you worded it, so you were able to answer yes. Something like Rogerian therapy, where you're reflecting feelings, he's not really focused on making sure that the response is always that accurate. I mean, there's always a yes to it. That's right. But in hypnosis, we depend upon that yes set. And so with a formal trance induction, I will often use just what I see. You're sitting there in a chair and you could, if you really think about it, you could feel the warmth between your back and the back of the chair.
Yeah.
If you're wearing jeans, you could feel the tightness of the material over your knees.
Yeah.
I will use those kind of cues, which I know they're going to answer yes to it. And that's the induction. But in therapy, I don't have to do a formal induction. I just use the yes set. I just reflect back in their language what they're saying, and they go into a trance. So I don't feel like, and you may say, does everyone go into a trance? I think pretty much everyone does. There are the, I think a person who is mentally retarded to some degree probably doesn't go into a trance. But most everybody else can go into a trance, whether it's real deep or not. I think it's something that's very automatic, and at least in my mind, in terms of therapy. You asked a question, and I sort of I lost my train of thought where I was taking it.
That's okay. I asked about the epigenetic connection with your trance therapy, but we're down to having 2 minutes left, so we probably haven't got enough time for that. But I just wanted to make sure our listeners once again knew how to contact you and how to connect with your Zoom groups, and that's via your email is your best connection, and that's brinknick9@gmail.com.
Yes.
Yeah.
brinknick9@gmail.com. You're, feel free to contact me.
Yes.
No matter where you are with Zoom. I mean, like I said, the Zoom groups I have now are from British Columbia clear to Germany at this point. The UK. I haven't had anybody from Australia recently. I did have one Australian person and one in a conference group that I had, but But I think that the time difference there may make it more difficult, but
you just got to get the times right. There's some certain times that work really well for the Australian American Alliance. So like this time that I'm talking to you is generally pretty good. It's good for you and it's good for me. Right. So it's morning here, late afternoon there. And that's kind of a good time as well.
Yeah, and our Tuesday evening group starts at 7 o'clock at the same time.
Perfect.
So that would work fine. I also have a Friday morning group that starts at 10. And that worked well for the people in Germany. I had the two different times just to be able to reach out to more people that way.
Yeah.
For the two groups that I have now. And you know, I'm open to starting another group if I get too many people involved in this group. I mean,
Dr. Brink, it has been such a delightful pleasure to talk to you this morning and explore this whole realm of ecstatic trance and how it can be used to heal and align your spirit and soul. And at 80 years young, I hope you have many more years to share this amazing information with us. And I'm very appreciative that you've come on Radio Tony today to talk to me. It's just been a divine pleasure, and I hope you have a wonderful evening.
Thank you. Well, one question, is this available on from the archives? How long will this be?
It will be. I will send you the links for our interview as soon as Don gets it to me, which is usually incredibly prompt. So later today, I'll get the links and I'll email them to you. And it's also
That'd be
been
great.
Up streaming live on my Facebook and LinkedIn as well. So, but I will send those all to you.
Thank you.
And we're out of time. Okay. You take care, Dr. Nick, and thank you so much for being on Radio Tony. Over to you, Don, and bye for now.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Thank you for watching and listening to Tony TV. For more inspirational stories, join us next week. Bye for now.